Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to your Partner in Success Radio, hosted by serial entrepreneur Denise Griffiths. Denise offers a full menu of on-the-web services for all your online needs. Denise and her team of virtual assistants can help manage your online business, including social media channels, blogs, web portals, and more. YourOfficeOnTheWeb.com is a comprehensive resource to help you combine the power of your brand, your connections, and innovative ideas to develop a full online strategy that can guarantee a strong profitable impact on your business.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to your Partner in Success Radio. I'm your host, Denise Griffiths, and each week I am honored, absolutely honored, to share the microphone with the most interesting entrepreneurs, authors and speakers, and business people who have wonderful stories to share and who are excited to freely share their business wisdom, their tips, and their actionable advice. In short, they're willing to help us shorten our learning curve as we navigate the know, like, and trust economy. And today I'm excited. I'm speaking with Gordon Treadgold, known as the leader's leader. I love that. He has worked in transformational leadership roles for over 20 years, running $100 million plus in programs, leading $200 million in global operations departments, and implementing large, complex organizational change programs for Fortune 100 companies. And he's now a visiting professor at Staffordshire University. And this is why he's known as the leader's leader. Take a breath, because I'm going to have to. He was selected by Inc. magazine as one of their top 100 great leadership speakers. He's the number one leadership expert to follow on Twitter, and I do follow him. I suggest y'all do as well. He was selected by Inc. magazine as one of their top 100 leadership and management experts in 2014. He was selected by Evan Carmichael as number one leadership expert to follow on Twitter for the last 10 months. He has over 400,000 followers on social media, over 270,000 on Facebook, and 150,000 on Twitter. He is number two in the top 15 most read leadership blogs and number four on the top 50 most socially shared leadership blogs. He is also the author of a new book called FAST, Four Principles Every Business Needs to Achieve Success and Drive Results. And his FAST leadership method is hailed as one of today's most relevant and business-minded approaches to increasing success and the speed at which it's achieved. I have his book. I was just chatting with him in the green room. I'm about halfway through it. It's a fascinating book, and we're going to talk a bit about that. Gordon, good morning, and welcome to your Partner in Success Radio.
Good morning, and thanks for having me on the show. It's my pleasure. You forgot to mention I was English, so they might need to pay extra attention to the accent.
Well, between my Southern and your English, we're going to have a lot of fun. Listen, you have a fascinating bio. Can you tell our audience a bit about yourself that you think that I might have missed that is relevant to our conversation today?
I think my background was predominantly in IT, leading large projects then, and I studied mathematics, and I'm very good at problem solving. I like sport, and I'm very competitive, and I mixed that problem solving and competitiveness together to try to look at how we could rapidly solve problems, and this allowed me to progress in my career, and eventually got me to write the book FAST, and I've worked in... I worked and lived in Holland, Germany, Belgium, Czech Republic, US twice. So it's an approach that has been appreciated by different people, different cultures, and I've been able to implement it on with small entrepreneurs, large companies, and global and virtual teams. So, yeah, that's pretty much about me and my FAST approach.
What started you down this path? I mean, you didn't just wake up one day and say, I'm going to be a leader. How did you get there? I mean, it's a valid question. How in the world did you go from being, you know, a scruffy teenager to being a leader's leader?
It actually started when I was about 9-10 years old. And I played a lot of sport. And what I always thought was that I wanted to be the captain of the team. I wanted to be able to make a difference. One of my key strengths has always been ability to solve problems and keeping things simple. And I always thought that when we played teams, I could always contribute a lot. But people didn't listen to you, or you didn't get asked unless you were captain of the team or the leader. So from an early age, I decided I wanted to be in the decision-making process. You know, I wanted to be part of setting the course we were going to take, setting the goals that we'd achieve, and the only way to do that was as a leader. And that's what got me started in doing it. And then when I worked in IT, I was involved in a lot of projects where I saw us doing some crazy stuff that was questionable, and the only way to fix it was to be in charge.
Well, that makes sense, and you know, I have kind of the same mindset. I'm the oldest of a whole bunch of kids, so I'm bossy by nature.
Yeah, I was the oldest of five as well. I forgot to mention that.
I figured that you might be. I think it's something we all have in common. But you grabbed a hold of it at a very early age, which, it would think it would be uncommon, but it's really not, is it? I mean,
No. Once
you have that knowledge about yourself and you're willing to understand how you operate, then you can take it and run with it, can't you?
Yeah, well, the other thing as well, when we played sport at a young age, one of the tendencies was to put the best player in charge. But you see that in sport throughout the world and across all sports, that it's not the best players who make the best coaches and managers. It's the people who have the best understanding of the game. And I always felt I had a great understanding. I was never the best player in the team, but I always felt I knew what was best for the team and how to get the best out of people.
Well, that makes sense. It really does. Listen, I have been watching some of your videos, and particularly those about FAST, because the book, and you mentioned something in the, let me back up just a bit, you mentioned something in the green room about a comment that you got from another reader. I would love for you to share that.
Oh, about the, so the book's only 140 pages long, and one of the best comments I've ever had on the book was that they had to read the book twice because they got so much value out of it the first time. They were convinced that they'd actually missed things, even though it's only 130 pages long.
Well, like I was telling you in the green room, I'm about halfway through it, and I've got sticky notes all over the darn thing. One of my first sticky notes went in on page 49. It said, and I struggle with this, I'll be honest with you, I do. You know, we all like to think that we can multitask, particularly women. You know, we're convinced that we can just multitask up a storm. And it has come to my attention as I get a little bit older and hopefully a little bit wiser that that's a really stupid idea. And one of the things that I found is at the very bottom of the page is pick one task at a time and give it 100%.
Yeah.
And you're right. It's hard for me to, you know, come around to that idea, but I'm slowly coming around to it, and I'm really trying to focus on one thing at a time. Do you have any tips that you can give people about how to just block out some time and block out all the mind chatter and just focus?
Yeah, I think we need to do that. We need to go and find some quiet time. I mean, I know when I'm writing, I actually try and go into my study and turn everything off, because what I used to find was I would do some of the writing in front of the TV, and then I'd include dialogue from the show. Because, you know, when we get interruptions, it causes us, we make 50% more errors when we get interrupted.
Right.
And tasks take 50% as long. So we have to find quiet time. And one of the things I would also suggest as well is you have to do a personal assessment. And I know that's a grandiose phrase, but what I'm going to say is very simple and straightforward. When are you at your best? Figure that out and then look at doing the things that are most important at that time. For me, I'm an early riser. I wake up between 5:30 and I'm out of bed by 6 every single day. Even the weekends, I've always been like that. And my mind is the most alert between 6 and 9 o'clock. So for me, when I do writing, that's the time that I write. And, you know, I could waste that time watching Mike and Mike and their chatter about football. I could watch local news stuff that's interesting but not really that important, or I could take my most productive time and use it most productively. And that varies from people. Some people are better in the evenings, some people the afternoons, some like me, early mornings. So plan to do things when you are most productive, and then you'll get the most out of the time.
I do the same thing. I have found that I'm actually a morning and a night person. You know, I'm very, very productive first thing in the morning. Like you, I kind of jump out of bed, my mind is racing, I'm ready to go. Then I have a lull about mid-afternoon. I get tired, my brain gets tired. I need to go out and watch the dog chase squirrels or chase squirrels with her. And then about 7 o'clock at night, I'm right back at it. But that's fairly recent. That's only the last couple of years that I found out that I actually have two really productive times. And I've learned to take full advantage of those times, those time slots.
So I'm a little bit different. I'm very creative in the morning, and I have that kind of lull during the late morning and afternoon with yourself. But then in the evening, I'm actually able to focus on getting things done. So I'm not as creative at night, but I am able to sit down and get things to closure. And closure is one of the most important things we can do, because I used to work in IT, and we used to do a lot of planning. And one of my mentors, when we used to do that, said that any task is only 50% done until it's 100% done. So even if you think you're 95% done, in reality, we only count that as half done. And that was a mentality that I took forward. And the only way for things to be done is to complete them. And I would rather have 5 out of 10 things 100% finished than 10 out of 10 things 50% finished, because those two things are not the same. In terms of effort expended, it can be the same, but if you've got half of your things 100% complete, you're in a great position, and it's motivating. When we achieve success and tick things off, there's kind of like that, yes, we've got the adrenaline, what's next? But when we're only halfway through things and we start something else, that's not as motivating. It doesn't encourage us towards success.
Well, not only that, but there's a mindset that goes along with that. I don't know about you, but I have an advanced degree in beating myself up. It's like, really, Denise, you didn't finish that? And then, you know,
I think if that was an Olympic
event,
it would be the most participated in sport in the world.
I think it would. And nobody beats us up better than we do ourselves. And you're right. It's kind of a self-perpetuating, oh, my gosh, oh, my gosh. And you're feeling behind the eight ball, and then you're racing around trying to finish something up. It never ends well. So I'm with you. Finish up something, anything. Finish it up. Get it checked off that list.
Yep.
And then go for that win and go, woo-hoo. You do your little cheer off the sidelines and then go on to the next thing, because it does impel you forward, doesn't it? Rather than having all these, you know, with painting. If you ask me to paint a wall, I'll go to a pizza parlor. I hate painting. So I know better than to start it. You know, but it took me a while to figure that out, because I'll have a half-finished wall forever and it will drive me crazy forever.
Yeah. Procrastination's a killer.
It really is.
And what we have to be aware of as well, you know, both of us suffer from the same thing. Great in the morning, low in the afternoon, good in the evening. So don't plan to finish it in the afternoon. If you plan to finish it in the afternoon, you're probably going to fail because you're having a lull. And then you're going to beat yourself up about it. Don't do that. You know, move on to something else in the afternoon. Go and chase squirrels with the dog. And then plan to finish it in the evening. You know, give yourself credit. Our brain is massively powerful, and it's much better when our brain is focused on encouraging us rather than beating us up. Because if we look for excuses for why we're rubbish or we're going to fail, our brain is awesome at finding excuses and reasons. And we want it to be focused on finding solutions and working with us, and it being our best friend, which isn't always the case.
Absolutely. Are you a list maker?
Mentally, not. I don't tend to write down a lot of lists, although I'm just sat in my office looking around at the number of lists on the wall, which might be an indication that I am a little bit of a list maker. But when it comes to lists, what I tend to do is I tend to write down the outcomes I'm looking for. Not the things I have to do, but the results I'm looking for. And the reason for that is that, you know, this comes back to the book and the F of fast focus. And I always say that you need to understand what success is. And if you understand it, then you can write down what the goal is clearly. And there's research that shows when you write your goals down, you're 42% more likely to achieve it. And if you share it with somebody, you're 78% more likely to achieve it. So I'm always keen on writing down what I think the outcome's going to be rather than the tasks I need to do to achieve it.
Sorry, I was punching the wrong buttons. I was punching speaker and mute, and I had all kinds of stuff to say. That's actually brilliant. I am an inveterate list maker. My lists are gorgeous. They're color-coded. They look like a mind map. And the thing is, I've found this to be true recently because I'm doing a lot of cleaning up and kind of figuring out what my systems should be. And I'm finding that these lists that I've been making since I was old enough to write really don't stand me in good stead. And I didn't know why until you just said what you said about creating, you know, figuring out what the outcome is and then basically working backwards from that, what has to happen to achieve this outcome. I didn't know that. I mean, I just had a big light bulb go off over my head.
Well, it's great to tick off things I wanted to do, you know.
Definitely.
But it's even better to tick off something and say, achieve that goal, rather than the steps to achieve it, to be able to say, yeah, this was the goal I was looking to achieve, and I've got that done. And what I also find as well, and this is when I was younger, I was terrible at this. You know, you'd be revising for exams at school, and I would spend 3 hours coming up with the absolute best revision plan you've ever seen. It was color-coded, it broke down by subject, it broke down by time, it talked about, you know, reading, when I was actually going to take some of the previous papers. It was fantastic. And by the time I'd got all that written down, I'd run out of my creative energy, and I'm now into that lull, and I haven't done anything.
Right.
Other than create, I would have been better off spending that 3 hours focusing on maths or physics or English or a subject I didn't like rather than focusing on a task that's just not it's not constructive. It's good to have a plan, but when the only thing you've written down is the plan and you actually haven't made any progress, that's not a great place. And I used to be terrible at that. I'm a Libra, and we struggle to decide at times. So sometimes doing something else is an easier decision to make than trying to decide between, you know, do I revise physics or chemistry? You know what? I'll create a plan, and then I won't have to decide.
It is a very high-level form of procrastination, and I finally worked that out. So, you know, it's fun, it's interesting to do, it didn't make me a dime, so why am I doing this? It didn't move me forward, it didn't do anything for me at all, but it sure is purdy, but it didn't do anything. So,
the other thing I find is that if I have to write down 10 steps to achieve a goal I'm looking to achieve, that quite often once I start doing it, halfway through I find a better way of doing it. And I actually ignore what I've written down and take some shortcuts. So, you know, one of my favorite quotes is genius is 90% perspiration, 1% inspiration. But I think that quote's the wrong way around. Sorry, that quote's the right way around. And often people say it the other way around. It's 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. I think you have to sweat in order to realize this is dumb. There's got to be a better way of doing it. If you try and come up with the better way before you've broken any sweat, you're not going to find that right idea. So get stuck in, and then you'll find the shortcut once you get sick of doing something. But that won't happen
Absolutely.
When you're just at the planning stage.
Right. I know in your book you talk a lot about simplicity and keeping things simple, and that's kind of what we're talking about now. Why is that important? I mean, why is you just gave a good explanation, but is there something else that we should know?
Yeah, I think when it comes to simplicity, people need to understand how they are going to be successful. And we have a natural tendency to overcomplicate things. And I was actually just doing a class module on simplicity. And, you know, Albert Einstein said, you know, we have to keep things as simple as possible. Einstein had an IQ of 160. Genius is 140. So he's able to work and deal with complex levels. But what he knows is that not everybody is as smart as he is. So he has to keep it simple so that everybody else can understand it. If you're the only one that understands how your department or your team is going to be successful, you're going to fail. So you have to be able to communicate things simply and easily. People are not afraid of hard work, in my experience. They're afraid of failure. And that fear of failure comes when they don't understand how they're going to be successful. And I worked on a project one time for Cable and Wireless, telecoms company, and we had to deliver a project in 3 months, which normally took 18 months. And I wasn't in charge of the project. I was just one of the leadership team. And we spent the first week creating plans. And we had 27 different teams working on this project. And it was all about how we could sell things like web hosting, telecoms products, voice over IP, these kind of things. And we had 27 teams working on different products, the infrastructure team, the hardware team, and we spent a full week planning. And we had plans that could paper the White House. I mean, we put them up on the walls, and we had every single inch of the wall covered. So we had a great plan, yet nobody had any clue how we were going to deliver this project. And the boss said to me, "What do you think?" And I said, "Well, I don't have time to read this and understand it, but we don't have any, we're starting from scratch, we have nothing. So if it's a 3 month plan, why don't we just make month one, buy and install the hardware, month two, install and configure the software, and then month three, trial the four products we're trying to sell. Why isn't that the plan?" And he just looked at me and said, you're now in charge.
Oh.
Because he could see how we were going to do it. Month one, buy and install the hardware. Month two, put the software on. Month three, test it. Now, had we made the work any easier? No. All of the same tasks needed to be done. But now we were able to communicate. We were able to split it up into three different plans. Tell the infrastructure team, we started in October. You guys, from October 1st to October 30th, go and get, we don't care how you do it, you've got 1 month to get the hardware done and installed. To the software team, you've got a month to design it while the hardware team are building it. Then you've got 1 month to configure and install it. And testing team, I know you're going to need more than a month, but you haven't got that. So you've got 2 months where you can design all of your tests. Then you've got 1 month to execute it. And we actually delivered that project in 3 months because people could see clearly what they had to do and when, and they understand what their role was. And it's massively empowering when you know that.
Well, I would think that it would be. How do you suggest that individuals who are overcomplicating their lives? I'm guilty. I mean, my hand is in the air. I'm guilty. And I know why I do it, because it's procrastination. I have figured that out.
Well,
but what do you tell people like me who are going, "Well, crud, I've got this great plan, but now I've made it so complicated, I can't even pick up the thread."
Well, things are, we do it in every area and every aspect of life. And I have some simple tips and techniques which I tell people. But, you know, one example of where we overcomplicate things is, how often do you go on vacation for a week or 2 weeks, you spend hours packing a suitcase, and at the end of the vacation, you come back on over 50%, a third to 50% of the clothes you never wore. You just never wore them, and you just bring them back clean.
Exactly.
I do that all the time. And, you know, when we have too much time to prepare, we tend to overthink things. And when we overthink, we overcomplicate. So try and do something. Imagine you only had a quarter of the time to do it. So now, if you've only got 15 minutes to pack instead of an hour, what are you going to pack? You're just going to pack the essentials, you know, changes of underwear, toiletries, a couple of T-shirts, whatever you need to do. And you're going to, it just changes that mindset. If you only had 15 minutes instead of an hour, what would you take? And then put those in and then take that as a basis. Now, I'm not suggesting we leave our packing to 15 minutes before we go. But when we do that first round of packing, just imagine you've only got a quarter of the time you need. What are you going to do? And then once you've done that, you can actually build on that and take a little bit more time. So you're starting from 25% of what's needed, and you can look at increasing it to maybe 30, 40, 50%. But if you take 100% of the time to do that thinking at the start, you'll end up with 100% of what you'd have taken previously, and you'll end up with way too much stuff. So try and do things in a... Imagine you've only got a quarter of the time to do it.
So taking action is important. Sitting around thinking about it is probably... Let me back myself up a bit. You've got the idea. You've got maybe a product or a service that you want to offer. Instead of sitting around planning, plotting, and praying, you should actually take some massive action.
Quickly. Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of your listeners are entrepreneurs. I deal with entrepreneurs all the time in my coaching practice. And one of the things I always ask them is, who's your target market? And they say, oh, it's everybody. And I say, come on, it can't be. If it's everybody, it's nobody.
Yep.
Okay, imagine now you've got to sell 10 units today. Where are we going? You've got 1 hour to sell 10 units a day. Where are we going? And they immediately go, okay, well, you know,
no
most
idea.
Of the people that buy my stuff are women who visit spas. Okay, that's your market then. Let's start with that as your market. Don't be aiming at the full range of mankind. Let's try and narrow it down. So accelerate what you need to do. Imagine you're compressed, and it will focus your mind. And we cannot focus on complicated things. So we really try and do that focus. It forces us to simplify as well. So just imagine you've got a quarter of the time, or you've only got one item left. Who would you sell it to?
Well, there you go.
Well, and with one of the things I found with entrepreneurs, there's only two or three ways that we can increase our revenue. One is to sell to new customers. The other is to sell more or at higher prices to our existing customers. Those are the only two ways. And every time I ask, you know, entrepreneurs, you know, how can you increase your revenue, they come up with 100 different things. I could do this, I could do that. No, there's only two ways of doing it. Sell more to your existing customers or at a higher price, or find new customers. That's it. And you need a plan for both of those. And if you've got plans for other things, then those plans are incorrect, because you can only make money by selling to new customers or more to your existing customers.
Right, that I do know. So basically, we're back in that kind of round robin type of thinking, aren't we?
Yeah.
Instead of focusing on those two things, we're like, oh, you know, I can expand here and I can go do that. Again, I'm thinking it's another form of procrastination or a fear
Absolutely.
Of failure.
Absolutely. How many entrepreneurs, and I've just been part of an entrepreneurial group, so I have a kind of an idea on this myself, but what percentage of entrepreneurs love to sell?
Oh, gosh. I'm going to say not much. I mean,
it's
not something that's fun, is it? It's not.
No.
We don't enjoy
I mean, it's where the money comes from. No sale.
Oh, yeah.
No, sales are like oxygen. Without it, you're going to suffocate and die. So
right.
if I put off identifying who my target market is, that's a way of procrastinating over. I don't. Well, I of course I want to sell. I'm just trying to figure out who to. No,
I hear this all the time, Gordon. I'm a web developer, and constantly this will come up no matter who the client is, no matter how much experience they have. The minute I ask, well, who's your target audience? Oh, everybody. And I just wait for it because I know it's coming. I have never had that conversation, not once, where it didn't come up.
And I can honestly say that mea culpa, helper. I'm just as bad as everybody else. You know, doctors are great at giving out advice, but not great at taking their own medicine, as it were. So I do struggle with this because I'm not keen on sales either. I'm actually good at it once I get in front of people. I just hate the whole having to do it kind of a thing. So it is procrastination. And another area where I find with entrepreneurs is, I did a fast, intensive workshop for a full day, and I asked the group, you know, what's your goal? And I think as entrepreneurs, we have to have a financial goal. So I asked the question, and somebody put their hand up immediately. I was like, wow, brilliant. Somebody who actually knows what their financial goal is. And I said, so what's your goal? And she said, it's to make more money than last year.
Ouch.
Well, how much money did you make last year? I made $75,000. So you're going to be happy with $76,000. No, I want much more than that.
$100,000.
I'm not sure. If you don't know what your financial target is, how can you put a plan in place to achieve it?
Mm-hmm.
If you're selling things, and just to make the math simple, if you're selling things at $1,000 each, and you know you want to make $100,000 in revenue, then you have to sell 100. That's 2 per week.
And
now
let's
you
not
know
forget
what
the profitability. You know, are you profitable? Making money doesn't
necessarily
mean that you're profitable.
And
no, I have this all the time because I also coach virtual assistants. And by the time we break down the numbers, and I've said this before, so you're making about $1.50 an hour, aren't you? And they don't even know it.
Yeah.
By the time they back out taxes and the cost of their team and, you know, the cost of their internet and, you know, there's a lot of money that goes into creating a business and running a business, even if you're doing it in your basement. And I think people don't understand that.
Yeah, well, I cover a lot of that under transparency and fast. Do you know what's involved? Do you have clear visibility into your pricing structures? Because if you don't understand that, then you don't know what your profitability is. And I was doing some work with a client a few months back, and they were making $20,000 a month in revenue, and their business was going crazy. And she asked me to come in, and she was really interested in simplicity, because what she wanted to do was she wanted to simplify things so that she could make sure that the growth was going to be easy to manage. And the first thing I said to her was, that's great. How much profit are you making? And she said, what? And I was like, red flag. Absolute red flag. Before we grow, we need to understand that are we making profit or are we digging a hole? And we went through it, and she had she was selling products that were made up of multiple components, and each component had different suppliers. And depending on and it took her a while to get the invoices in, so she was always like 6 weeks behind in understanding what the actual cost was, which makes it difficult to price, by the way. And when we actually went and did the analysis, we found that half of the time she was selling the profits at 50% margin, and the other time she was selling them at 5% margin.
Oh,
I said, look, if you're making $20,000 in revenue at 5% margin, you're earning $1,000 a month. You might as well go and work at Starbucks. At least you'll get medical. And so we looked at that, and we ended up cutting back her revenue from $20,000 to $15,000, but that $15,000 was all making 50% margin. So now she's generating $7,500 a month in profit, which is great off of $15,000. But now you're in a position to grow. Now when you grow that business, you're going to be making great money, whereas if you grow at 5% margin, you know, even if you grow it up to $100,000 in revenue, you're not going to be making big money at all. It's crazy.
Gordon, why do people do this? I mean, you've been working with people a long time. Do you have any kind of insight into the psychology that tells people that, you know, they can just put money out there, you know, they can build a team, they can build a product, they can sell it, and they've got all this money coming into, you know, PayPal or their bank or wherever the money's coming into? Why in the world, what is stopping them from saying, okay, here's the math, pure and simple. This is what's happening. This is what's going out. This is what's coming in. This is my profit margin. Doesn't matter if you're a virtual assistant or if you're running a factory. I see that way more often than I'm comfortable with seeing it, to be honest with you. And I'm always very puzzled by the psychology.
Yeah. Well, according to Bloomberg, 80% of first-time businesses go bust. And so this is a very common problem. And according to the New York Times, two of the key reasons why businesses go bust is lack of a cash cushion and poor accounting and poor pricing structures. And I think some of the reasons behind this is that sometimes people are experts, and they're experts in, you know, you might be an expert florist, and that's where all of your expertise is, and you end up, you know, with no background in accountancy, probably a dislike and minimal skills in mathematics, and you just avoid that area because I'm such a great florist. This has got to work, and you're now putting hope as a strategy. And you know, the reality is that hope is not a strategy. You need to have a clear understanding of what your pricing is, because if you get the pricing wrong, and I worked for a multinational, and we got the pricing wrong, and we grew the business. We tried to grow the business by 20% from 10% market share to 20, and we ended up making a over $1 billion loss because we were. The pricing was so complex, we didn't get it right, and our costs were prohibitive, and it was $1 billion. So it's not just small people. So you need to get somebody in that will come and do this. You know, find some time, go and get your accountant, go and sit down with an accountant and get them to look through it and look at what the profitability is. Don't hope and don't believe that just because you're an expert, business is going to come to you. You know, we have to fight for every single sale, and we need to make sure we get the pricing right so that when we fought for that sale, it was profitable. And as you say, too many people, I don't know if they don't understand that, or whether it's, you know, down to hope. But it's a delicate business, and just because somebody else is doing it cheaper doesn't mean that you can be doing it for the same prices either. You have to create prices that reflect your costs, not somebody else's. And if that means that you will not win the business, then that's a great indicator to actually not go into business.
Exactly. And I see that, again, all the time in the virtual assistant industry in particular. People will say, oh, well, you know, I'm watching this group of types of virtual assistant, let's say concierge VAs, and they're charging $25 an hour, and somebody else over here is $95 an hour, and I just don't know how to, you know, make business in between the two. And I just want to tell them, stop comparing yourself to other people. What are your skill sets? What do you bring to the table? How are you marketing yourself? How are you making and closing the sale? Quit watching other people. I mean, don't base your pricing structure on other people because they have different skills. Find out what your skills are and market the heck out of them.
And find out what the demand is from your
customer,
your target
exactly
customers.
Right.
You know, When you look at cars, there's no point in Hyundai trying to come out with a car that's going to compete with Mercedes, because they're two completely different markets, two completely different customer sets. And you have to find out, you know, what's your offer and who is your ideal market. And it's interesting, when I actually got my book edited, I used a website that I'm sure your listeners are familiar with, Upwork it's called now, it used to be Elance and Odesk. And I got an editor to edit the book, and it cost me $250 for 25,000 words. And people said to me, yeah, but you know, when you're using people in India and Manila, don't you worry that their English is not going to be as good? I said, well, actually, this editor lives in California, and he's been doing it for 25 years, that it only took him 3 hours to do the full edit. And at his hourly rate, he could actually offer to do a much better fixed rate deal than somebody who was only charging $10 an hour because of the speed with which he worked. So his hourly rate looked like it was prohibitive, but the quality and speed with which he worked allowed him to bid and compete with much lower people because he was of a higher quality. So you need to understand what's the value that you bring. And, you know, don't lower your prices just because somebody else is charging $10, $20 an hour if you're worth more than that. You're actually underselling yourself.
Oh,
and there's
a lot of
people I know in the coaching business that have found that when they've increased their rates, they've increased their number of customers. Because not everybody's looking for cheap and cheerful.
No, it's perceived value. If people understand that they can come to you and you may be charging $100 an hour, but you're going to get in and get it done in 2 or 3 hours, as opposed to dragging it on and on and on and on, while the $10 person struggles with it, there's really no competition there.
Sure. I mean, I do some coaching on social media. I've been built a following of 150,000 on Twitter. You know, I know quite a bit about it. And somebody came to me and said, how much would you charge me to coach me on Twitter? And I said, I'd charge you $350 an hour. And they were like, no way, I'm a lawyer. I charge $350 an hour for legal work. There's no way yours can be as valuable as mine. And I said, well, you know, go find somebody else that will teach you. And she ended up coming back to me. And we actually did the work in about an hour and a half. So when you look at the hourly rate that I was charging, yes, it looked expensive, but I told her everything she needed to know in 90 minutes. So for around $500, she was able to get everything she needed, whereas somebody else who would have charged, you know, they would have charged a lower hourly rate, but the total cost and quality of information was not going to be, it was going to be a higher price for less info.
Now I have to ask, did she actually take that information and implement it?
Yes, she did.
Oh, good. Because some people don't.
Well, yeah, this is one of the things with the entrepreneur group that I worked with. I did a full day of fast with them, and you know, one of the first things I talk about is write down what your revenue target is. And I was asking people 4 weeks after, and people who gave video testimonials saying, this is great, what a brilliant idea, this makes perfect sense. And you would ask them, and they would say, like, yeah, I haven't done it yet. And a lot of the time, it's people don't want to, you know, they don't want to write it down, because when they do that, it's like they've made a commitment and they're going to feel bad if it doesn't happen. But as I said, you get 42% increase in probability of it happening just by writing it down. So,
right.
You know, follow this stuff. This is why people are successful, because they take action. Everybody who waits for success to come to them is going to be waiting an awful long time in an awfully big queue.
And you would think that wouldn't need to be said, but it does.
Well, that's right. Success is a journey, and it's not the journey of success to you. It's a view towards success.
And that leads me to my next question, Gordon. You mentioned in your book that in order to be successful, we need to improve our effectiveness and our efficiency. What's the difference between those two?
So one of the examples I give for that is you've got a car that's in the mud and the wheels are spinning like crazy. The engine is being very efficient in converting the horsepower of the car into the wheels turning, and the wheels are going round, massively efficient, not using a lot of petrol. However, you're not actually making any progress. They become effective once they gain traction and start to move the car forward. So if you've just got efficiency and no effectiveness, basically you're spinning your wheels. And you need effectiveness. And then once you start moving, then you can be focusing on efficiency so that you get more effectiveness and more of that power pulling you forward.
And that takes me back to my focus. I struggle with focus because I have one of those squirrel brains. I think we all do. But my
yeah.
squirrel brain is, you know, it ratchets up every once in a while. It just wears me out.
Shiny object syndrome.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, absolutely. When the first time I saw that phrase, I went, oh, how did they know? They're talking to
I'm trying now to write my fourth book, and my desk is in front of the window, and I know more about my neighbors' goings and comings than I ever did before.
But, you know, my office used to be in the back of the house, and I have this gorgeous backyard. It's beautiful, and I've got big pecan trees out there, and I do have squirrels. And I would catch myself just drifting off into space and going, oh, man, I got nothing done. Well, I moved my office to the front of my house, which faces out onto the street. I could care less about my neighbors, so I'm not tempted to go watch the cars drive by. It's a very quiet neighborhood, thank goodness. But I'm not distracted by wanting to go out and sit under the, you know, the pecan trees or dig. Yep. My favorite thing is to garden. So I had to physically move myself. You know, away from all that. I really did. Okay, so here is, and I'm still back on page 49. This is where I stopped reading when we picked up the phone to talk. And one of the things that you said here, and I'm going to read this out of the chapter if you don't mind, said, remember back to a time when you were really focused and passionate about something that you're working on and you seemed to slip naturally into the zone, or you were with the flow or got in sync with what you were doing. I live for those moments. My question to you, is there any way to kind of train yourself to slip into those moments to make them happen without just kind of waiting for them to happen organically? Is there any way you can kind of just go, okay, I'm ready, here I go?
So the first time I spoke on fast, now I'd spoken a lot in my professional career to departments and teams, but the first time I actually got paid for speaking professionally, and you speaking in front of an audience, it was quite nerve-wracking. And my brother, who does who's an NLP coach, he came with me, and before we rehearsed a lot of what we were going to say, you know, which is normal. But what he did was he used a technique with me, and as I said, both of us were big rugby players. And he took me to one side and he just said to me, you know, do you remember when we played that game we were playing for Leicester Rugby League team? Do you remember when we played Nottingham? And you gave that team talk because this was important. If we won this game, we won the league. And you got everybody psyched up. I was like, oh, yeah, I remember like that was yesterday. He said, can you feel how, do you remember how passionate you were? And I was like, oh, God, yeah. And he said, are you feeling it now? And I said, yeah. And he said, clench your fist really, really tightly. And I clenched my fist really, really tight. He said, okay, come on, let's go get them. And I was like, you know, we were like laughing. I was like, yes. And he said, okay, before you go and speak, every time I want you to clench your fist, and I want you to, you've sunk that emotion now and you've associated it with clenching your fist. And every time you're going to speak, I want you to clench your fist and just think, come on, let's go get them. And he said, and you'll go out with the confidence of when we started that game. So I think there is a way to try and do that, is to imagine that time when you were the most passionate and then anchor that emotion. And you could do it with like clenching your fist, or another one I've heard is pinching your creating a pinch with your finger and thumb, and you try to just turn that on. Now it works for me when I go speak. It's not 100% foolproof, but it is a technique that I try to use. And even when I was describing it to you, I could actually feel my body heating up.
Right. Well, yeah, it sounds like something that I do. In fact, I did it before we got on this interview. I saw a TED Talk by a professor named Amy Cuddy. Have you ever seen it? Where she's basically saying the same thing that you're talking about, but she does what she, I think it's Wonder Woman. I can't remember who these cartoon characters are, but
yeah,
just the wonder. It's an amazing TED Talk, Amy Cuddy. But basically, you know, she just says stand up and put your hands on your hips and go forward. And I do that every time I'm about to get on the radio. There's just something about it. Somewhere along the line, I program myself to be very excited about it, and I notice that I'm standing up straighter. Yeah, I'm taking deeper breaths, and I go into these interviews because I know that I get to speak to the most interesting people, and I'm very excited about it. But I do my little Wonder Woman pose before I pick up that phone. It's just
so
a habit
why not
now.
So do exactly the same when you've got an important task. You know, think of something.
That's a good
when
question.
When you went in and you wrote a business plan and you did it in a day, something you did that was you're massively proud of, and just anchor that emotion and then boom, you're in the zone. I mean, it could be So we haven't talked about this, but one of the things I do a lot of, I run, two and a half years ago, I started marathon running. I was fat, unfit, old, and I decided I wanted to do it. And one of the things I found with marathon running is that it doesn't matter how far I've run, how tired I am, if Rocky, Eye of the Tiger comes on, I just run with a bigger spring in my step. So we just have to... Honestly, I'm not kidding. You hear the music, it's like... And the other one, you know, the Gonna Fly Now, the theme from Rocky. When those two pieces come on, I just automatically run faster. It doesn't matter how far I've run up to that point. When those two pieces of music come on, I'm, you know, I'm emotionally connected to it. It means a lot to me, and it just, the adrenaline kicks in, and I move forward. Now, I haven't tried running an entire marathon just to the soundtrack of those two tunes. I'm not sure whether that would work. But
well, it gets you started, though, doesn't it?
Well, a friend of mine, she's a speaker, and she does a lot of coaching and workshops, and I had a session with her when I was working in my last company, and we had her and a gentleman called, so she's called Julie Starr. She wrote the coaching manual. She's fantastic. Check her out. And another coach I had was a guy called Mark McGregor, who's Canadian, former ice hockey player, former ice hockey manager. He has a personality which is just larger than life. And when he speaks, he just booms energy into the room. And Julie's quite petite, quite soft-spoken. And he ran the first day, and she did the second day. I thought, how's she going to create that same kind of energy? And I asked her that. She said, I'm just going to do it with music. So she went and got some rock music, turned the rock music up, and the music put the energy in the room. So we can. There are these tricks and tips that we can use to get us into the zone, things that remind us of when we were successful so we can repeat that feeling.
You know, I hadn't even thought of anything like that, but there are pieces of music that just instantly resonate with me. And one of them, and not necessarily in a good way, is that two-tone note that you hear from the movie Jaws. You hear that, and you're like, oh, gotta go.
<You're out. laughs> Yeah, if I'm stood near the water and I hear that music, I take two paces back.
That's right. I mean, we're just conditioned to go, oops, okay, let me go do something else. But that's some great advice. We've only got about 8 minutes left. This has been the fastest hour. What I wanted to ask you is, how did you come up with fast? I mean, it's a process. I mean, you teach fast, don't you? It's not just about the book. It's something that you actually teach.
Yeah, it is. So how did I come up with fast? It's I was working with somebody, and we were talking about, you know, I was helping him, coaching him through interviews, and I asked him, what was his three greatest strengths? And he said, I don't know, what are yours? And I thought, honesty, I thought, no, everybody's honest. There must be more. You know, what are the things that actually differentiate me from other people? And I sat down and I thought, it's simplicity. I'm fantastic at keeping things simple. Transparency. I'm a very transparent person, but I also like clarity into where we are and what's going on. If I'm on a diet where I want to lose 10 pounds in 10 months, I'll plot a chart of what the progress will be, and I'll weigh myself every week and see how I'm doing, because you need transparency into progress to know whether your approach is working or not. If it's working, celebrate. If it's not, change it for something that does. And the last thing I thought was, every time I ask people, you know, what's one of my defining qualities, and they just go, laser focus. You have a laser focus. And I thought, okay, so these are my three strengths, simplicity, transparency, and focus. And when I got my first paid speaking gig, I was going to talk about the benefits of simplicity, transparency, and focus. And I got a speaking coach called Nigel Risner, often the number one coach for CEOs and speakers with a lot of the CEO groups. And he said to me, simplicity, transparency, and focus. He said, I like that, but you're trying to sell simplicity. What about accountability? Do you think that's important? I said, well, yeah, accountability, it's so important, it goes without saying. And he said, yeah, but if you say it, Now you've got focus, accountability, simplicity, and transparency, and you've got fast. And you know, it's like now when I say that, the hairs are standing up on my arms, because it was like the penny just dropped, and I was like, yes, that's right. And I able to look back at what I'd done, and everything just fell into place with that statement. And focus is about what it is you're trying to do, accountability is about the who, simplicity is about the how, and transparency is about the how far do we have to go and how far have we gone. And it was, as I say, it was like a light coming on. It made it a lot easier to explain. People remember fast a lot easier than they would simplicity, transparency, and focus, which is a mouthful. So I really appreciated Nigel making it simple for me. And I've now gone back and I've run courses on it. I talk on it. I've written the book, and I'm actually working on two more books, Faster and Fastest, which about fast is about how to achieve success. Faster will be about how to sustain it and ensure that you repeat it. And then Fastest is about how do you achieve your optimal performance. And they'll be coming out next year and the year after.
Well, you've got to come back and talk about those.
more than happy to do that. And I'm also thinking about doing one that's just called Fast for Entrepreneurs, because fast is an approach that I've used. I've used it to running a marathon. I've used it for running projects, departments. I use it for my social media. And in the book Fast, I talk about the principles of it and how you can apply it to everything. But I'm thinking of writing one just called Fast for Entrepreneurs, where I apply it very specifically for entrepreneurs. Because what I tell you in Fast is you need to know what success looks like. Whereas with entrepreneurs, it's very easy to say you need to know what's your revenue target and what's your customer segment. Those two things, I would say, focus on those two things, and you'll be in a much better shape. And then the same with accountability. Accountability, I would talk about for entrepreneurs, is you need to have people working in the business. And a lot of entrepreneurs, like myself, we're experts. We're comfortable working in the business, but you need people working on the business. And if you don't have people working on the business, you're going to be out of business in 3 to 6 months. And then simplicity.
Yeah.
Yep. Simplicity, as I say, it's new customers or existing customers, and you need a plan for both. And then transparency, what's your pricing structure, and what's the progress you're making? So able to really bring it down and push it for entrepreneurs. So I'm not sure whether I'll write that as a book or I'll actually do that as an online class.
I was just going to say, I think that would make an excellent course.
Well, I'm just creating the Fast course now, and that'll be ready in time for when the book launches in October. But yeah, I'm thinking about doing that as a course as well. Because the good thing is, you know, you can sell a course for $1,000, whereas a book's only $20. So financially, it might be more beneficial, shall we say? But
well,
yeah, I think it would be a good course.
Yeah, definitely. But it's not just that some people. People learn differently at different times in their life. Just take a book, for instance. I like to have several versions of the same book. I like to have the paperback or the hard book. I like to have it on Kindle.
Yeah.
And if there's any possibility at all of getting it on audible.com, I'm going to go get it there as well, because at different times during the day or different points during the month, just pick one, I'm going to learn something, you know, the same information. I'm going to hear it differently or read it differently. It just depends. And, you know, we're about 60 seconds away, but I wanted to ask you, one of your key principles is accountability. We've talked about that a lot. And I can hear people in the audience thinking, but I'm a very responsible person. Isn't that part of being accountable? Yes
no.
or no? That's what I thought.
No, accountable is about standing up and saying, I'm the one who's going to get this done. And we, as leaders, leadership defines culture, and accountability starts with us. So we need to be accountable. And even if you're a solopreneur, when you're dealing with your suppliers, if you are accountable, if you are one who makes commitments, meets commitments, turns up on times for meeting and is prepared, that will have a knock-on effect to how they interact and operate with you. And then the other part about accountability is having clear roles and responsibilities, so you know that who's working in the business and who's working on the business. Because too often things fail because a task got left because we didn't assign it to somebody. So that's what accountability is about, and it's massively, massively important.
Listen, can you tell people where they can find you on the web?
Yeah, so I keep things simple. They can find me at gordontredgold.com, or they could follow me on Twitter at gordontredgold. And my book.
And you're also on Facebook, right?
I am on Facebook as well. I have a page on there called Leadership Principles, which was my original leadership blog. And you can find the book fast on Barnes & Noble's, I think is it Nook? Or the Barnes & Noble site on Amazon. If you just Google Gordon Treadgold, it'll show you the three books that I've written, and you'll be able to order fast, which comes out October 20th.
And for our audience, there's a link in the show notes to the book and to Gordon's website. Gordon, you've got to come back. I'm going to just do it right in the show so you can't tell me no.
I love to talk to people about this kind of stuff. I love sharing it. I'm absolutely passionate about it because I know it works. And I want people to be successful. That's why, you know, when I was working with my branding coach, we went with the leader's leader. My goal is to make everybody as successful as they can be. And if they use and follow fast, it will improve their success. So I'm massively passionate about it.
Well, thank you so much for being with me here today. It has been wonderful chatting with you. And I'm telling you, I had a couple of light bulb moments. You should have seen it. You know, one of those big old giant pre-Edison light bulbs or it just went off over my head. But anyway, I know our audience has enjoyed the takeaways as much as I did, and the show for everybody who is listening right now will be available for download in about an hour, and you can also find us on iTunes. Just type in our names, Denise Griffiths and Gordon Treadgold, and I will see you next week. Gordon, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
You can find Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com or at gottagovirtualnow.com. Thank you for joining us on your Partner in Success Radio.